Welcome to the Food and Beverage Processor Forum, brought to you by Food and Beverage Ontario. I'm Dyson Wells.
And I'm Chris Conway, CEO at Food and Beverage Ontario.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Food and Beverage Processor Forum. Today we're joined by our guest, JP Gervais, Vice President and Chief Economist at Farm Credit Canada. JP has a wealth of knowledge and experience when it comes to economics and finance, and we are thrilled to have him with us today to discuss some of the most pressing issues affecting the industry. In this episode, we'll dive into the topic of rising interest rates and inflation, and how these factors are impacting both processors and consumers. With JP's expertise and insight, we will explore the latest economic trends, what this means for businesses in the food and beverage processing industry, and what we can expect in the future. So if you're interested in staying ahead of the curve, and understanding how these economic shifts are shaping the industry, stay tuned.
JP Gervais is Vice President and Chief Agricultural Economist at FCC. He has over 20 years of experience analyzing domestic and international agricultural policies and markets, and his insight helped guide strategy and monitor risk throughout the corporation. He's frequently a speaker at national and international conferences, addressing global trends and the linkage of agri-food markets. In addition to acting as an FCC spokesperson on economic matters, JP provides commentary on agricultural industry through videos and FCC Ag Economist blog. Prior to joining FCC in 2010, JP was a professor of agricultural economics at North Carolina State University and Laval University. He also held the Canadian Research Chair in Ag Industries and International Trade at Laval. JP is past president of the Canadian Agricultural Economics Society. He obtained his PhD in economics from Iowa State University in 1999, a year of which I heard was quite the party. So let's jump into our discussion on economics and inflation, which just goes to show we are well out of our college years. So JP, to start things off, when we're talking about inflation and we're talking about interest rates, what are the expectations in 2023?
Well, great to be here. Looking forward to a great discussion. I mean, inflation, I was going to say arguably, but I don't think you can argue this. Like, inflation was the number one topic in 2022, in both inflation in general and then food inflation as well. And guess what? We started off 2023 talking about inflation as well. So it's all topical that we're here discussing this, right? So inflation, If you look at where general inflation, because when I think of inflation, two things stand out for me. First is inflation and interest rates, and then second is the overall topic of food inflation, right? So if we focus on trends, overall trends in inflation, I mean, we're at 6.3% at the end of 2022. Pretty soon we're going to get the first our data points for January of 2023, but right now we're at 6.3%. So it's quite elevated. Inflation is more persistent than everybody thought. I mean, go back 12 months ago, I'd be the first one to admit I never thought that inflation was going to be this persistent in the economy. So bad on me and bad on a lot of economists not to be able to raise the flag that would have been needed then. So inflation's been persistent, still very high, right? Way off the target of the Bank of Canada, which is between 1-3%. But there are credible signals right now that inflation will be coming down. And in fact, if the trends of that we have seen for the last 6 months, if they do continue, we're going to hit 3% of inflation by early summer of 2023. So we're not that far off from seeing inflation overall in the economy come back down to 3%, you know, by summer, early summer, and then perhaps hopefully also as well going towards the midpoint target at 2% in the rest of that second half of 2023. So that's that. So credible signals that inflation is slowing down. Now, with regards to interest rates, businesses, consumers in Canada have had it really hard. I mean, like, we've seen the Bank of Canada raise interest rates for good reasons, so 4.25% in 2022 and the first interest rate increase of 2023. So the question now becomes, like, what should we expect for the next little while here? And I think we've had the last increase of the Bank of Canada. So let's just put that on the table. I think we're done. I think the bank's done raising interest rates. because of what I was saying just before this, right? We have credible signals that inflation is going to be coming down. Consumers' wages are going up, but not at the pace of inflation. So in real terms, consumers are losing purchasing power, slow down in consumer spending. That's going to slow down overall inflation. And that's the story to bring down inflation, right? So we think that we've seen the last increase of the Bank of Canada. But for businesses that have to make decisions as to, you know, should I be, if I have investments to make, or should I be locking in rates for the long term, or should I wait for those short-term rates to come back down? A couple of things need to be analyzed, I would say, right? One is everybody's talking about a slowdown in the Canadian economy, as well as the global economy for 2023. I think this will happen. Whether or not it's going to be a recession, I think it's an interesting question, but I don't know that this is the most relevant question asked. There will be a slowdown. I don't think this could be argued. You know, the extent to which we can argue about it, debate it, but I just don't know that this is actually very critical to understand whether or not there'll be a recession. I think the main point is that if there is a slowdown, and I believe there will be, I don't expect the Bank of Canada to do anything about it. Like inflation, it will just hit the 3% by summer. They will need a lot more time, at least another 6 months, I would say, to really be confident that inflation's down and before doing anything with regards to cutting interest rates back, right? So we're going to have to navigate this high interest rate environment for most of 2023. Now, interest rates are all about forward-looking expectations of what is going to happen in the future, right? And to that extent, because the markets, financial markets are saying, and I'm going to end with this so that you can ask me a few other questions, but this is really critical to understand, right? So when financial markets are looking at what are the expectations going forward, they believe, they understand that there will be an economic slowdown. They understand that the bank at some point is not going to keep interest rates where it's at. It's probably going to go back towards the overnight rate of the Bank of Canada going back towards 3% or so. So financial markets already are expecting this to happen, not in 2023, but later on, late 2023 or early 2024. So what has happened when it comes to long-term interest rates, if you think of a five-year fixed rate, think of a mortgage, or think of any type of investment where you lock in that interest rate for 5 years, these rates are based on the bond markets. And really what we've seen bond yields now for the last 3 months, we've seen bond yields for a five-year term of a five-year bond actually come down. So that five-year rate has already come down to some extent. Now, can it come down a little further? Absolutely. I think it will happen. Maybe another 25 basis points, maybe another 50 basis points. But my point with all of this is that if a business is waiting for saying, hey, I'm not going to do anything, I'm not going to lock in rates because there will be a slowdown, the Bank of Canada is going to cut rate, I don't think that's very accurate. I think you unfortunately will have to get through 2023 at high rates. And then second, if you wait before locking in rates for those long-term rates to come even further down, you might have to wait quite a bit, actually, because those rates have already started to come down, right? So the last 3 months. So bottom line is, I think, you know, whether your strategy has always been short-term rates, variable rates, or whether your strategy has been long-term rate, fixed rates, I think what you have in front of you is really what you're going to have in front of you for most of 2023. There will be some changes, obviously, but for the most part, you have the information that you need to make that decision and then manage that financial risk within your business, right? So expect rates to plateau, stay high for a while, and maybe late 2023, maybe see a little bit of relief would be how I would summarize, you know, the outlook for interest rates in 2023.
Okay. I guess my next question will be open to both you and Chris, because I just want to get a bit of a picture of how this looks for the food and beverage processing industry and the businesses within it specifically. So what does this look like for an average processor, and how is this affecting them both in inflation and with interest rates?
Chris, you should take this one first.
Sure, absolutely. So I think, you know, a few things to think about there. If we're going to start seeing decreasing pressure in interest rates, then that's obviously going to be helpful for food processors in many respects, right? Because people have business loans, that sort of thing. Also, there's been talk about, you know, supply chain improvements, there was an article yesterday talking about labor shortage and potentially ongoing issues with that and some impacts there. But I think on the whole, it's would be seen as positive for our sector to have that. The other aspect, however, of overall economic slowdown, I mean, food is largely inelastic, although there's all kinds of substitutes and alternatives, as we've seen, you know, in recent months where people maybe are avoiding buying expensive items, things like that. But the sector overall, you know, certainly the retail side of things has performed very, very, very well. So I think if this plays out, as has been mentioned, that would be on the whole good news for our industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm going to pick up on one of the things that you said, right? In terms of labor challenges, we have a really big challenge in front of us, right? So if you look at labor shortage, that's been well documented, right? But I think if we think of more of a long-term perspective and really think of the need to invest from the industry, from food processors, and doing it in the context of high interest rates, obviously, if interest rates come down a little bit later on in 2023, towards the end of 2023, that would be a really good thing. If you look at job vacancy rates, to me, that's sort of the statistic we use, the number of jobs that are available for workers to be looking at, right, and apply and be hired. If you look at that job vacancy rate for the entire economy, and if you look at that pattern for that statistic and compare it to all the industries within the agri-food supply chain, so not just food processing, but as well at the farm level, at the food service level, even trucking, I mean, all those industries that are connected to the food supply chain, that job vacancy rate is everywhere higher than the national average. So in the food supply chain, we got tons of issues in front of us in terms of labor challenges, and in the food processing sector for sure. And if you extend this, one of the things that we've done late 2022, and this is available on the website at FCC, if you go fcc.ca/economics, we've ran some long-term projections. Basically, when you do 10-year projections, there's a lot of different scenarios out there, right, in terms of immigration, natural rate of population growth, and all those type of things, right? So you bring all these assumptions in. And if you go 10 years, best case scenario is that we're basically looking at status quo, like in terms of the labor market remaining tight for a number of years. And so that, I think, speaks to the need for food processors to find the capacity. And this is not easy to do, right? But find the capacity to invest in all those different things that need to be done, automation and so forth. This labor challenges not only has been a source of inflationary pressures, but it's also is a source of competitiveness issues, perhaps, or in terms of challenges down the road for the entire agri-food supply chain, really.
Hey, Chris, I know that there's we've mentioned, well, FBO has mentioned quite a bit that there are resources available to food and beverage processors on supports and funding for helping them automate their processes, as well as to digitalize it, which I think also kind of leads into this discussion.
Yeah, there are a number of government programs out there that have, Emergency Agri-Food Worker Protection Program is giving out funding up to $50,000 for, COVID-related retrofits, for example, is one. We recently had the Grow Ontario strategy announced a few months back, and there's a program related to that for supply chain, actually. There's a $9.8 million fund that's come out now, and many other funds. We just wrapped up the Agri-Career Support Initiative, which was another one. So yeah, there are many, many funds out there at any given time. We're trying to help people navigate those, and we partner with organizations like the Adaptation Council in some cases to deliver those, or other groups to help get information out there. But certainly there's lots of support out there for the sector. In some cases, if you're dealing with a small or medium-sized business, you know, getting through that and understanding sort of the complexity of what you're applying for can be a bit of a challenge. So that's where we're trying to help get over that hurdle and assist people as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. So when it comes to adapting to this, to these challenges, you know, what are some additional resources and tips that processors can lead towards when they're looking at this?
Well, I mean, the one thing that stands out to me is financial risk and managing it, and as well running some, a little bit what we're doing as a financial institution, what we call the stress testing. Well, it doesn't have to be called stress test, but the idea that, hey, if markets evolve a certain way, if my inputs, you know, commodities that I purchase and process are coming up in prices and by this much, how would that jeopardize, or maybe not in terms of jeopardizing the operation, but certainly how much pressure would that put in my ability to service debt and those type of things. So that's in the context of high elevated interest rates for the year coming down towards the end of the year. I think that's one thing that I would be looking at as well. I think, let's face it as well, 2022 has been a really difficult year for margins in the food processing sector, especially in the beverage sector, I would argue, but even in the overall food and beverage industry itself, I mean, those margins have been tighter. There was a little bit more, and that speaks, generally speaking, right, obviously different sectors face different types of pressures and so forth, but overall, I would say in 2021, it was a little bit easier to pass on the higher costs. 2022, not so much. And we've seen margins being a little bit tighter for food and beverage manufacturers. And the outlook for 2023 looks a little bit better. So we are actually forecasting that margins are going to improve for a couple of reasons, one of which is supply chain. And we briefly mentioned it, but those supply chains are actually showing some credible signs as well of improving. Globally, if you look at all the indicators, if you're sourcing inputs from other markets and so far other countries, I think globally, I think supply chains are trending in the right direction. I mean, those transportation costs are coming down. There are lots of different signals that are suggesting that those supply chains are improving globally as well as domestically. I mean, there's always a little bit of a lag, right? So you get products all the way to the port, and then within the borders, sometimes you're not seeing your supply chains run as smoothly as, for example, it is in the case for global supply chains. Nonetheless, I do think that there is improvement. So that's one source of improvement in terms of margins and so forth. Second is commodities themselves. I mean, we've seen commodities retreat from the highs of 2022. Now, they're still way above the average of 2025. I think that they will remain above the average, the five-year average as well, in terms of overall commodity prices, whether it's for crops or livestock or other inputs like, just the other inputs like materials and so forth. Nonetheless, I do think there will be relief. And so that's another source of relief that I believe will be supportive of the sector in the sense of perhaps, you know, giving a little bit more margin in terms of making different choices when it comes to investments, ability to do different things from an innovation standpoint and so forth. So I do think that there will be a little bit of relief in 2023 when it comes to the profit margins of the food and beverage level.
Well, thank you for the easy transition, because that's something I was curious about when it comes to commodities. My question is, what are the hardest hit commodities when it comes to inflation? As well, what remains stable and relatively the same? It's always interesting for me to hear what commodities are affected, and it's not always what you'd expect necessarily, especially on this complicated topic and focused on an industry that is affected by an assortment of factors. So I guess to start it off, what kind of commodities have been hardest hit by inflation?
So this is a really good question, because at the end of the day, you look at retail. So we're not talking commodity here for sure, but if you just start at retail and look at all the different food products, it's pretty even in terms of, like, food inflation stands at 10.1%. And at retail, it's pretty even. Like, the distribution of inflation for food across the different product categories, it's pretty even. Of course, there'll be differences. Of course, you know, you have certain products that are showing 20% in year-over-year price increase at the retail level. And you have other products, you know, meat is a good example, red meats especially, where inflation lately has been in that, you know, 0 to 2%. But, I mean, as well, you know, a result of really, really high inflation figures, you know, early or late last in 2021, early 22. So you have to be careful here, right? But my point with this is that what we've seen at the commodity level and the way that it has fed through the supply chain, when we add the supply chain challenges, transportation, energy, when we had labor issues as well in terms of wage increases that we've seen at all levels of the supply chain, I think that explains really well to me what we're seeing in terms of inflationary figures that we see all the way up to the consumer level. Of course, the war in Ukraine has been a major disruptor, right? So if you are a processor, buying crops, you know, especially grains and oilseeds, major disruption. And we've seen prices in the first half of 2022 really skyrocket because the markets weren't sure. Like, we weren't sure what kind of supply would be available. Now, let's not forget as well, this war in Ukraine happened at a time where that balance between supply and demand of commodities was already tight to begin with. We already were projecting that the markets were going to be tighter than normal. And then on top of that, had major disruptions to, you know, two of the largest commodity producers in the world. I mean, that's a recipe for the inflationary pressures we've seen at the commodity level, right? So no doubt, I think, you know, if you look at grains and oil seeds, it's been definitely a big driver. The war in Ukraine has been a big driver. I mean, one of the things as well, demand for vegetable oil has really skyrocketed driven in part, you know, partly the war has been having an impact, but as well as some of the mandates when it comes to renewable diesel, biodiesel, and so forth in other parts of the world. And that has really pushed the value of vegetable oil. If you look at livestock, you know, supply has been tight or has been coming down slightly for different reasons, drought in the US. So, you know, livestock producers, you know, cutting back on the size of the herd, no plans to expand or cutting back on expansion plans and so forth. At a time when demand for food, that's something that Chris mentioned at the very beginning, right? Demand for food is very resilient. I'm actually a little bit surprised, I have to say, because yes, you know, we're a sector that, you know, demand's pretty inelastic and consumers need to eat and all that. But even that external demand from countries that normally would be a little bit more sensitive to prices, meaning that, you know, in Canada, we're pretty fortunate. We have some food security issues in the country. I don't want to dismiss that, for sure they exist and so forth. But for the most part, we have access, because of all the productivity gains that have been made in the food supply chain, we have access to a safe, high quality supply of food at a very affordable price for the most part. And that's despite inflation that, like, we've seen over the last 12 months. But foreign markets, they're a little bit more sensitive to higher prices. And yet, you know, demand's been very resilient. And so demand's very strong, supply's tight, weather issues, supply chain, the war. It really is, I believe, a across-the-board type of phenomena when we think of commodity prices. So it's hard to highlight. I mean, each of the commodities are influenced by different factors, specific factors to them. But I think overall, I think the general outcome is pretty much the same across all commodities. Elevated, higher than 5-year average, with a little bit of relief coming up for 2023.
Okay, that's good. It's interesting about the demand remaining high within the food, with consumers. And I guess just in layman's terms, what is 2023 going to look like for consumer level?
At the consumer level, I'm expecting that inflation is going to remain elevated relative to overall inflation, right? And so it's going to be, let's say, interesting, for lack of a better word, to understand the narrative around food inflation for 2023, because we are likely to find ourselves in a situation in which we have general inflation that's coming down, right? I mentioned at the very early stage of this podcast that, you know, we expect inflation overall inflation to be around 3% by summer. Yet inflation right now, overall inflation is 6.3, food inflation is 10.1, and it's not showing sign of coming down. So we might find ourselves 6 months from now in a situation where food inflation is running much higher than overall inflation. And that's what I meant by interesting, in a sense that some of the discussions around food inflation and the solutions around, you know, to bring it down and so forth, they might even get a little bit more intense, in the sense that if indeed, you know, we have food inflation that might be coming down. At the end of the day, I do think this is going to come down, but it's not going to come down as fast for a lot of the reasons we discussed already, right? So labor issues, supply chains slowly getting back to normal, you know, commodities remaining elevated, that just tons of different reasons why, you know, I think we're going to have to be comfortable with the idea that food's going to be a little bit more expensive for us Canadians. We've been fortunate, really. Like, our share of disposable income spent on food has been declining for 20 years. Now, COVID has brought lots of different disruptions, you know, at all levels of the supply chain. But and now inflation, high inflation is bringing this ratio, the share of disposable income that we allocate to food, that inflation is bringing this up. but it's still lower than what it was 20 years ago by a large amount, right? So I think probably have to change our expectations as consumers. I think food inflation will be coming down, no doubt, but it's going to take a little bit more time than what we were saying for overall inflation, is my guess.
Chris, do you have any questions specifically?
No, I just to echo that I agree with that. I think there's, you know, so many things that we see going on in the food processing side where, you know, some of this stuff has been very pervasive, you know, whether it's been supply chain, whether it's been labor shortages and so on. And these things, you know, maybe starting to get better. They're not corrected yet. So you're still going to see these effects showing up. So I completely agree with that, that, you know, it's, and it'll correct over time. And, you know, it's a bit of a mystery sometimes with the retail side. You know, they're making a lot of money. We don't really know where they're making their money. One chain said it was cosmetics and not the food. Found that hard to believe. But, you know, certainly, you know, we'll see what happens with things going forward. You know, with some of this stuff and some of the pricing. And I do find as well, like on a personal level, you know, there are so many substitutes that you really can, if you work it a bit, you can figure things out. So that's also very, very helpful. We're fortunate in Canada that, you know, maybe you're not buying the best cut of steak, maybe you're buying something different, but you can largely figure it out. People who are low income is a very different story. Then it starts getting to be very, very challenging. So, but at any rate, it's a relief to hear that things are going to be improving, I think, overall, and the conditions are going to be improving for the sector. And certainly we've had also good government support in terms of their programming that's starting to identify some of these issues and put support behind it as well.
Yeah. And Chris, you bring an excellent point as well when you mentioned that, you know, consumers getting or scaling back in terms of the value that they put in their food basket, right? So I love it because, you know, I hear a lot, you know, all food is an industry immune to recession. Yeah, because, you know, we still have, you know, we're pretty fortunate in Canada, we're going to eat by and large. And I said, not discounting some food security issues with some segments of the Canadian population, but consumers do make choices, right? And we see them scaling back in terms of the value that they put in the baskets just because prices are higher, right? So some food processors might see recession or, you know, the purchasing power of consumers cutting down as a good thing in a sense that if they're in that, you know, targeting the segment of products that are slightly of lower value in terms of the scale of value that that businesses offer for a given product category, some businesses might find that a recessionary environment or an environment in which, you know, wages are not going up as high as inflation might be a good thing, whereas other businesses that are, you know, aiming for that higher kind of range of the quality and value of the product category might find it a little bit more difficult as consumers look to cut back and find some savings there, right? So we have, by and large, an industry, food beverage industry, that is immune to recessions in the sense that overall, collectively, but within the industry, I know that businesses will find in 2023 that consumers are looking to find some economies and savings here and there.
I want to pose a question specifically more on the beverage side of the equation. You may have heard this in the news recently, and it begs the question what alcoholic beverage producers might be looking at in 2023. Canada recently decided to recommend you only have, I hate to say this, but 2 drinks max per week. And when I first heard this, I immediately wondered what this will mean for alcoholic beverage producers. And how is this going to affect consumer trends? You know, we got a lot of interesting interviews and on-the-street interviews when this story first broke. The question seemed to be whether people would actually abide by this recommendation or if they would just choose to have those extra drinks throughout the week. But question the same, what does this mean for alcoholic beverage producers and consumers?
I can start. I mean, I'm no expert on health and certainly when it comes to alcoholic beverages and so forth. So I'm not so sure that to what extent this could influence consumer behavior and so forth. But the one thing I'll say though is that it's been a difficult year, 2022, for alcoholic beverage manufacturers. We look at margins in that sector. It's been really hard to pass on higher costs, especially in that sector, if you compare it to other sectors of the food manufacturing industry, food and beverage manufacturing industry, mostly because of the competition, right? So we've had, it's a highly competitive sector. And because of that, it's a bit higher, a bit more difficult to pass on some of the higher costs. And we've seen this in the margins that we calculate for the industry, where we've seen these margins shrink a lot more in the beverage industry than in the overall food and beverage industry. So to me, that, and then part of it was as well, you know, higher commodity prices and so forth, and all the reasons we've discussed already. But I think competition and the ability to talk to your retailers, talk to your customers who are not necessarily the end customers, but retailers and food service establishments and so forth. It's been more challenging, I would say, on average, is what I've noticed. And as well as we're still trying to get our footing under getting back in a post-pandemic world, what this looks like, right? This huge shift that occurred when we started off with, you know, with lockdowns and the economy and so forth in 2020. And that huge shift towards, you know, doing more food or more of your food purchases, you know, being directed at home versus and food services that were basically shut down. And now we're getting back close to what the equilibrium was. We're really, really close to back to what it was early 2020 before the pandemic hit us. So we're still trying to figure out what this market's going to look like post-pandemic, how much, you know, of the change in behaviors of consumers will you know, how much of that will remain, you know, and that what how consumers have behaved through the pandemic, and how much of that will remain going forward. And on top of it, just to your point, right, how much a news like we've heard and statements like we've heard will change the outlook for the demand of the beverage industry.
I could just add a comment about that. You guys may be aware, but I'm a dual citizen with France. I lived in France, the experience there with this, with wine, you know, over 10 years ago, they started a campaign and people started talking about reducing wine consumption. And I actually have an article here I found the BBC wrote about this. But what they found was, it's interesting, wine consumption did decrease and prescription medication use started increasing dramatically at the same time, such that France is now considered, you know, a very heavily medicated country. And, you know, some people in the wine industry are saying, you know, I have a good quote here from someone saying, you know, we used to drink, the exact thing I'll find here. Here we go. We used to drink 160 liters a year in the 1960s and didn't take any pills. Today, we consume 80 million packages of antidepressants and wine sales are collapsing. Wine is the subtlest, most civilized, most noble of antidepressants. But look at our villages. The village bar is gone. It's been replaced by the pharmacy. So that was a very contentious topic there when this started happening. And that was one of the effects, was that there was an increase in prescription medication while the consumption of wine or alcohol decreased. So we'll see how this plays out.
Do not take the wine away from the French. It seems like a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, it's that Churchill quote, we're not just saving France, we're saving champagne. So was the, I think, the famous one. And I know there was a lot of concern from our members on that side of things when those numbers, that advice came out and sort of the question about where it came from and so on. So that's still not really a done deal, that particular guidance. Mm-hmm.
While we're on the topic of, trending topics, and while we're talking about competition as well, I did see with the State of the Union address that President Biden had mentioned that he is still committed to a America First solution for manufacturing. And that raised a few alarms for Canadian manufacturers who are concerned about how this is going to be affecting them. And so I guess just, I'm not going to ask you, JP, to comment specifically on the president's address or anything like that, but what are we looking at when it comes to competition with the United States over the course of maybe this year and maybe the next year?
Yeah, so no, very good question. And I think we all benefit from an open, transparent trading system in the U.S. Like, for how many years, I can recall some discussions early on. I joined FCC in 2010 and even prior to that, like lots of discussions around how we need to diversify our export markets. Now, diversification is a lot easier said than done. Of course, you know, nobody wants to rely on just one customer, and I get that. But there's a reason why the U.S. is our largest buyer of food products. And that's because, you know, wealthy nation, largest economy in the world, located right next door. And for the most part, and then there's some issues we have, obviously, right, with the U.S. in terms of, you know, we don't like this, they don't like that. But for the most part, a vast majority of products we sell and food we manufacture, things are going well. And so I do think that we have a vested interest, to say the least, that to have a border that remain open, fluid, and work towards, you know, really making sure that we leverage as much as we can when it comes to opportunities. I'm all for diversification, absolutely. But one thing that we learned over the years, and that research is actually pretty unanimous in terms of the ability to export and what are the success factors behind exporting. And it's false. It's not a good thing. And it's false to think that if I'm exporting, then my productivity is going to go up. You really need to work in being productive and competitive in your own market before starting to export. And there are there's learning by doing. There's some lessons learned as you're getting into the export market. And the U.S. is no better place to start, I believe, than that, right? I mean, it's as I said, it's close next door, transportation costs are minimal, and so forth. So I think I think we need to leverage as much as we can, not giving up on the efforts to diversify, for sure. I mean, Canadian government just released a strategy with regards to Asia. China is a big part of the future of food demand, but it's also, when we think of our strategy when it comes to Indo-Asia, it's not just about China, it's also about India, it's also about other countries in Asia that offer great opportunities. I think we're going to make some headway there, for sure. But hey, I mean, the U.S. is our big market, right? And when you look at the breakdown of exports by destinations, for small and medium-sized businesses as well, I mean, it's critical that we have a border that remains open and fluid and transparent with the U.S. And for the most part, we're there. I mean, I just don't want to see any of that getting cut back because of efforts to buy more local in the U.S., for example, right?
Yeah, good point. JP, I just want to give you the chance to have an open mic for a moment. Do you have any specific things you'd like to mention specifically to our listeners?
Well, I mean, we do have tons of resources available at cc.ca/economics, our food report, which we basically are, this is when we release our projections for 2023 and then projections that are broken down by 9 different sectors. That's going to be available towards the end of March. So we're going to have to be a little bit more patient, but working on it right now. Hey, the future of food is exciting. I mean, we have lots going on for this industry, but hey, we need to recognize as well there are some tons of challenges. So knowledge is power, and hopefully that we can contribute in some small ways as well in making life of food processors a little bit easier in terms of sharing information, getting some data out there, and so for businesses to make the best decisions that allow them and to grow and grow their business. So that's what I would say at the very end.
I would just add that I find your updates excellent, and they're very specific to the sector and really drill down into some key things. So I'm on your subscription list, and I find the updates really, really good, and they're segmented out sometimes and so on. So I think there's something there for everybody, and anyone listening should have a look at FCC's site and consider subscribing, because there's a lot of good information there for our members.
Well, thanks for this, Chris. I'm super excited as well of our food report coming out at the end of March. Like last year was our first official food report, and I think we're coming up with some new twists there and new things as well that hopefully, you know, again, more forecasts, more information, and hopefully, you know, sort of cutting through the noise and really establishing some of the, what are the most critical things to monitor given by sectors, right? And so excited about it.
Okay. Well, like you said, JP, knowledge is power within this industry. So with that, I want to thank you for coming on and bringing that knowledge to the podcast and to our listeners. It's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you once again.
Thank you, JP.
Well, my pleasure. And hopefully we can do that again pretty soon.
On a closing note, while you're looking into all the great resources through FCC, I encourage you to also look up a resource designed to assist you in meeting your labor needs. Whether you're a job seeker or employer, part of a large enterprise, or a small mom-and-pop processing startup, Careers Now is designed to work for you. It's a program tailor-made for the food and beverage processing industry here in Ontario, specializing in connecting engaged employers with qualified job seekers. It features a suite of free employment solutions, including online job fairs, employment coaching, mentorship sessions, and skills training. If you're interested in learning more about the program or want to get involved with the association, you can visit our website at foodandbeverageontario.ca. That's all for today's show. Thank you for joining us, and we'll catch you next month for our next segment on Food and Beverage Processor Forum, brought to you by Food and Beverage Ontario. Take care, everyone.